This is tape two of the Frank Dennis interview. When the last tape ended, we were talking about Narahia. Would you talk a little bit about
One of the men who attended this conference was an American who then probably still lives in Mexico, pardon me, Guatemala. But he worked for the Campbell Soup Company, and he had made a number of tests of these fruits that could be combined, and Narahia made a very good juice in combination with coconia, with some other fruits. Mm-hmm. So he had grown in various places 600 hectares of this and for the testing for juice. So he was very knowledgeable. But he commented that Campbell Soup was all ready to go with this, and they had even printed labels for the cans, and he brought one with him. But at the last minute, they decided they couldn't get enough of it, and so they canceled the whole project.
Oh.
But as I say, he was a very good source of information. Mm-hmm. Now, so we had the first international conference on Narahia. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. this man who was working in Ecuador, his job terminated. He went back to Venezuela, and that was the end of the whole project. Mm. So I was always sorry that we didn't follow that up, but it wasn't.
In looking at changes, and you mentioned a little bit about the changes within the department at that time, how would you say that, was there any curricular change in terms of orientation toward both teaching and research? Was there, or how students learned?
I have to think about that. When I was graduate program committee chair at one time and chair of the curriculum committee, one thing or another, I would say that this is more personal. When I came, I started teaching a course in pomology, tree fruits, which had not been taught for a couple of years. Then later I team taught a graduate course in growth and development, which is not just hormones, but plant growth and development, mainly hormone physiology, that had not been taught. Well, pardon me, it was being taught. Gusta Hertog had taught it with several other people, but the other people had vanished from the scene, and so he was about to give up, but I said, okay, well, I'll teach that with you. We taught a plant propagation course, and I agreed to take part of that. That it had been taught by two people, one who was more woody plant oriented, one who was more tree fruit oriented. So I was the tree fruit man. There was also a small fruits course, small fruits being grapes, raspberries, strawberries, blueberries. So we had two fruit courses, one propagation course. Then, I can't remember now whether this came before or after, but I think this came with the crew, it wasn't the crew committee, but the restructuring and going from quarters to semesters. We had to cut back on courses as we went from quarters to semesters. Theoretically, you had to cut from three to two, to go back to two-thirds. So we combined the tree and small fruits course. The propagation course was rolled into a horticulture, two-term horticulture course, beginning horticulture. We still got down to the two out of the three, but we eliminated a number of courses, combined them with other courses. In terms of changes other than that, Jack Kai, who was our new chair after Carew, he came in 78, 79. He had gotten his master's here at Michigan State, had worked for Campbell Soup Company, and then he was chair of the vegetable crops department in Florida. But he interviewed for the job here and was chosen as chair in 78. He taught this, or a large part of this introductory horticulture course, because he wanted to keep a finger in teaching. The crew, I always think of this crew report, CRUE, mm-hmm. for it was
Council on the Review of Undergraduate
Thank
Education.
You. Thank you. That brought in a number of changes. Now, course, we taught, that started a senior seminar. I taught a senior seminar. I should mention that when I came, we had something like 80 majors. By the mid-70s, we had 500 majors. I always attributed it to my wonderful lectures, but it had nothing to do with it. It was the Green Revolution, or the Agricultural Revolution, maybe. So this is slightly off the subject. But we decided that with all of those students, we needed to have some preparation for getting jobs. So I taught a senior seminar for students who were going to be leaving, and brought in people from placement services and industry and whatever to talk to them about how to find a job. That I think when our numbers dropped, that course was dropped, but a new senior capstone was taught by Will Carlson. All these capstone, theoretically there were capstone courses for each department, each college, university, so on. Now I'm not sure just what has happened to them. I know that some of them have been dropped. Mm-hmm. That was a change in curriculum.
I know that shift occurred from in 1992. Mm-hmm. Was when that, yeah, that change, yeah, obviously was.
That we still had to drop a few courses or combine them. Mm-hmm. One course that I might mention, in the, here my dates, whenever I think it was 80, it was 70, and whenever I think it was 70, it was 60, and so on. But anyway, in the, let's call it mid-80s, there was interest in the college, in the part of going back to international courses and international programs. We hired Skip Bittenbender. Skip Bittenbender, I have to stop and think what his first name is. Not Horace, but that's close. Anyway, Skip Bittenbender was hired to be our international horticulture person. So he taught our courses in tropical fruits, tropical vegetables. I might mention that Bob Herner and I taught a course in tropical fruits, he taught a course in tropical vegetables. This was given intermittently. But Skip took this over and did that, and also he made contacts with a lot of graduates in other countries. His research was on crops such as, not pigeon pea, but crops that could be grown in the tropics. Mm-hmm. And he did some overseas research too in the Philippines. In fact, his graduate work, much of it was done abroad. So that was a change in terms of curriculum. Mm-hmm. He's now in Hawaii.
Did many of your students come from backgrounds, let's say in Michigan, from our orchard families, or?
Yes, many of the students in the tree fruits originally,
okay,
were students from Michigan families. Mm-hmm. Most of them were. I remember one, in a lecture, being from New York, we grew some plums, but not many of them. Mm-hmm. And I was talking about plums in the lecture, and a student from Hart Shelby was in the class. In fact, he had finished a coursework he had taken. He might have even taken a pomology course, but anyway, the pomology course had not been offered. So he decided, although he was a senior, he'd take the course. And he was very knowledgeable. This is Bruce Fox from Shelby. So he asked about, damson plums? Damson plums are a small plum that made into jam. Mm. And I said, well, damson plums don't amount to anything, that nobody grows damson plums. And he said, oh yeah, we've got 60 acres. So I learned at that point that Michigan grew some damson plums. I also remember his taking, I offered oral finals. Mm-hmm. In the course. So he took the oral final, and he did very well, and I told him, well, you've got a 95 or something. Now, just out of curiosity, how long did you study for this? And he said, about 5 minutes.
So it sounded like he'd been studying it all his life on the farm.
Yeah. Or in the orchard.
So how much he got out of the course, I don't know.
Yeah. Did you have, let's say you're in your teaching career here, you were long enough, did you have any two generations, let's say, for example?
I taught this pomologist tree fruits course with George Kessler when I started out, and I was always amused. George would say to somebody, "Oh, you're Sam Smith. Well, your father was Joe, wasn't he? And I taught him here. But he must have been here a long time." Mm-hmm. But I was doing the same thing by the end of the course. The Bruce Fox's son was in my course.
No, he came. You didn't tell his son that story about his dad, did you?
My own story.
Were they still raising damsel plums?
I think so. I'm not sure, but I think so. Mm-hmm.
The colleagues that you, and I know that you're doing interviewing for, is it, you're doing it personally for the department, or are you just doing it?
No, it's for the department. I have written, am writing this history of the department. I have been historian, photographer, and poet. In the department.
Okay.
So whenever somebody retires, I write a poem.
You write a poem.
And Dave Dilley is retiring on Friday. Well, he's retired, but he's having a party for him on Friday. So I'm working on a poem right now for Dave Dilley.
I see. And you've collected, have you collected all these poems as part of your work?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's all doggerel for the poet. But.
Uh-huh. And photography, have you gotten into that in terms of, do that in your research? Or
research, but I've also taken pictures at parties and in the field and so on and so forth.
Yeah. How have you found your oral history work in talking with
time
a lot
consuming.
Of the members?
Time consuming. I've interviewed about 30 department members, and what I do is to tape them, take notes while I'm taping, then type up my notes, triple space it, go back and listen to the tape, and fill in the blanks, of which there are many. Mm-hmm. I just can't take notes fast enough. Mm-hmm. So that it takes a great deal of time to do that. I don't try to make it verbatim.
I see.
But I try to get the facts, so mm-hmm. to speak.
Mm-hmm. And
then I give them the transcript, double spaced, mm-hmm. and ask them to look it over and make corrections, mm-hmm. so that the final transcript differs considerably from the tape itself.
Yeah, that's understandable. Yeah. Are there any of those interviews that stand out that? You learned a lot, or you're surprised, or...
Well, John Bukovac, most of these are 60-minute tapes, I think. Mm-hmm. John Bukovac took three tapes. And John, you may or may not know John, but he's a very particular, precise person. So he had quite a few notes that he used in making the tapes. And he had a lot to say about not only the department, but the American Society for Horticultural Science, of which he was president at one time, mm-hmm. the college, the industry. So it wasn't just his personal mm-hmm. life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I interviewed V.R. Gardner, who was head of the department in the 20s. He came in 1928, stepped down as head when Tukey became chair in 1945, but he remained director of the experiment station, and he retired about 48 or 49. Mm-hmm. But he lived in Florida, and he was about 90 when I taped him.
Mm-hmm. So some of those...
It's been interesting to me to see what people have done and what they emphasize. I think of Bukovac as being an outstanding one, but all of them have been interesting. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that in looking at, let's say, the last 50 years since the centennial in 1955, how would you say, at least also from your own personal experience in the late 60s when you came, how would you say that the last 50 years has affected the horticulture department and research on campus?
Well, the thing that I mentioned before is that there is a shift from pomology to ornamentals, particularly some to veg crops. Mm-hmm. Veg crops tended to be shortchanged in terms of staff members in relation to the value of the crop, but ornamentals has increased considerably mm-hmm. in value, and there has been a shift, probably not proportional even now. One thing that is dramatically different is funding, that the department is much more dependent on outside funding now. I would say, I'm not absolutely sure of this, but I think much of this has happened since Jack Kelly became chair about 78. And I have the figures, but the grants to the department, not only trade grants, that is fruit growers, vegetable growers, etc., have increased, but NSF, NIH, and so on grants have increased markedly, probably 500%, it's just no guess. The florist industry has provided considerable funding. That was an initiative from several of the department members, Will Carlson, Art Cameron, and others. They essentially, and I should say Royal Hines. Royal Hines was a very effective researcher. What they did was to approach the floriculture industry and say, what do you need? And then try to meet their requirements in terms of research. And they started several years ago, and they had a large donation from the florist, their bedding plant, mm-hmm. Bedding plant growers. They started a project in which they began growing perennials as annuals, and they were looking at all the factors that influence growth and flowering. So they looked at day length and temperature and nutrition and whatever else might be manipulated, and showed that many of these were photoperiodic. You could induce flowering if you wanted to induce flowering or delay it by certain photoperiods, temperature regimes. Now they can produce some of these plants. With bedding plants, it's best to have them in flower when they're sold so that the customer can see what he's getting, mm-hmm. he or she is getting. So this allows them to produce these plants in flower mm-hmm. at the right time. And I could go on about Royal Hines. He really did some excellent work. Mm-hmm. In
terms, is he still living? Or?
Well, yes, he retired at the ripe old age of 55 or 50. Maybe he's only 50. I don't know. He started like Liberty High Bailey. Uh-huh. It will be interesting seeing what he's going to do. Mm-hmm. But we had a party for him last year.
Oh, good. looking at your career since you got here, did you anticipate that when you came that you would end up stay here at Michigan State, or did you rest of your career?
I expected to stay here. I had queries about whether I'd like to be a department chair here or there, mm-hmm. but I never thought that I would care for administrative duties, mm-hmm. so I never applied for those. I've enjoyed the teaching and research that I did, mm-hmm. And I may have gotten stuck in a rut. I remember hearing a man from Ohio State, he never stayed in one place more than 15 years or whatever it was, because he'd get in a rut. But a lot of us are in a rut, I guess, if that's the case.
when did you retire?
96. 96. I took a job as editor of a journal for the American Society for Horticultural Science. Hort Science is the title. I talked with the editor who was retiring, and he asked him about the job, and he said, well, it takes me about 10 hours a week. Well, I soon found out I took about 20 hours a week on it instead of 10 hours a week, but that's because I'm a compulsive editor, probably. Mm. But he is, too. Mm-hmm. So when I confronted him with the fact I was paying that long, he said, well, maybe it was longer than 10 hours. But that was a job that uh-huh.
And you've continued that since
96? I did it for 4 years.
4 years,
and
okay.
I decided that was enough. I needed to do some work on departmental history, hometown history. I'm mm-hmm. also working on hometown history and editing a newsletter for the town of Rose in upstate New York.
Oh, okay.
My sisters still live there.
Uh-huh. So you get back occasionally?
Yeah, we were back there last week. Mm-hmm. We're now doing a cemetery project, photographing all the cemeteries, the tombstones in the cemetery.
Okay, well, DAR did that. I know lots of times around the turn of the century,
yeah.
And that's important because of the vandalism, local history, and
we are fortunate now that we have digital cameras. You can take about 200 pictures on one
shot, right.
So
and you can print only the ones you need.
The guy that suggested this lives in California. He had ancestors in the town of Rose, so I'm going to send them to him to sort out.
Oh, interesting. The looking back at your career, both in New York and also here in Michigan State, is there anything that, in reflecting on that, that you see as most important, at least from your point of view?
Most important.
I know that's a tough question.
Yeah. I didn't consider my research career to be particularly successful. There were a few high points, but I operated on the basis of the null hypothesis, if that means anything to you.
Okay.
And that I was always testing the null hypothesis, and usually I found out the null hypothesis was true, which isn't very exciting. If abscisic acid isn't responsible for dormancy, well, what is? What's new and different? Mm-hmm. But I always enjoyed the work. I particularly liked field work. I was not a very good mechanic. And during my lifetime, or my scientific career, mechanics became more important. So we went from bioassays to column chromatography, to gas chromatography, to gas liquid, gas chromatography, mass spectrometry, to so and so and so and so. And I just never was very good at these techniques. Fortunately, I had some good students who knew the way to do things. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't call that a disappointment. It's just a fact, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
That some people are very good with instrumentation. Now, Dave Dilley is a good instrumentation man.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't my forte.
Mm-hmm. But the field work sounds like it was.
Field work, yeah. I wrote a number of review articles that I enjoyed writing, I consider contributed to a scientific area. I enjoyed the teaching that I did, the graduate students that I worked with.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember how many approximately how many master's or PhD students that you've worked with?
I probably had 8 master's candidates and 10, 12 PhDs. It wasn't a large number.
The any activities since your retirement that you were involved in the local community or?
Oh, I do church work, if you want to call it that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm chair of a hunger task force, which sponsors Thanksgiving basket drives and canned drives and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I chair a board of church in society, which is responsible for benevolence, gifts to various organizations.
Mm-hmm. What church is that?
This is Edgewood United Church here in East Lansing.
Okay.
I've gotten involved in anti-war movement since the Iraq War. There's a group called the Greater Lansing Network Against War in Iraq.
Okay.
But after the Iraq War began, we had to change our name to Greater Lansing Network Against War and Injustice.
Mm-hmm.
So that I found that rewarding, frustrating maybe, but rewarding. We've done some investigation of the Palestine Israeli problem. We had a couple of speakers, one representing each group the other night.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether we will do more or not, but we had demonstrations, marches.
I see. Okay. Is there any other thing that you want to talk about in this interview that you'd care to share that maybe the big question I forgot to ask?
I have to go back and think about these things. I think I've covered most everything.
Mm-hmm.
I served briefly on academic council, university curriculum committee.
Okay, and
one of my major contributions there was editing, I think, because we would have these motions to something or other, and they would have to, in curriculum, there would be a description of the course. And there were always objections or suggestions and so on. So, well, does this really mean this or does it mean that? And I think I contributed something there in terms of straightening out the terminology.
In university governance,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, university governance. I didn't have a great role in that, but just part-time.
Well, that's an important part of one's academic career, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And you've seen a lot of governance changes on the campus since you've been here, too. So. Well, on behalf of the project, I'd like to thank you for the time and especially for your insights. I appreciate it very much.
You're welcome.